The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/Ian. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about different types of water and their Islamic laws according to Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwas. Sheikh Javid, you know, you told us about the cold water as one of those five types of water. If any amount of water which is equal to core, all right?
Yes.
We know that, for example, in the winter, it may freeze.
Yes.
All right? So a part of it freezes, though not all of it.
Yeah.
All right? Or it may be so that a part of it melts.
Yes.
Because of the heat, for example, around noon. And that part comes into contact with something ritually impure, najis.
Yes.
Does it become impure? I mean, like that...
The melted portion.
The melted portion, exactly.
You're right. Well, if a part of cool water freezes to ice, you know, leaving a quantity which is not equal to core, and then that part of the water which melts, and it's not core, of course, mm-hmm. Comes in contact with najasa, then, of course, there's no doubt that it becomes najis, because the frozen part is, you know, the water along with the frozen water constitute core. Now, this small portion which melts and it comes with impurity, that water is qalil. Yes, little water, and
because it loses its contact with the remainder of the core water, right?
Yeah. So, of course, it's considered to be qalil water, and of course, it will be najis, even if its taste or color does not change.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh Javid, what's the difference between running water and cold water, as far as purification is concerned, of course?
Well, there is no difference between the two in this regard. Mm-hmm. Both of them, you know, purify things. Both of them are considered purifiers or purifying agents. And they are equally, you know, purifying agents in every sense.
Yes.
But the thing is that if cool water comes in contact with urine or with blood or something which is essentially impure, and that and it changes in color, or it changes in taste or in smell, then cool water becomes impure. But running water, you know, running water, because it constantly oozes out from the earth, or gushes forth from the earth, like from a spring,
mm-hmm.
and it is flowing incessantly, then that portion or that part of the water whose color changes or whose smell changes or taste changes becomes najis. And the entire water does not become, you know, impure, because it's constantly flowing, and the old water is replaced with new water. So that old water which is contaminated with urine,
mm-hmm.
is najis, but the water which adds up and flows into the stream is considered to be pure, and it is a purifying.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice comments and answers here in the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We try to talk about some of the questions regarding different types of water and the rules or the Islamic laws about them according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
United States President Joe Biden has just reached the halfway mark of his term. And perhaps the best word to sum up the past 2 years is a new phrase. Polycrisis, which is defined as the simultaneous creation of several catastrophic events. Most of them started with foreign policy. Biden totally backtracked on his promise to re-enter the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy agreement, and then charged into exacerbating the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Sanctions on Russia have backfired so badly that the average family has lost over a month's salary since Biden took office, or $7,400. Biden came to power with total control of Congress, thanks to big campaign promises of rebuilding after the devastation of the coronavirus lockdowns.
The Build Back Better plan that was supposed to give you all these, you know, workers' rights, it was supposed to, like, you know, put so much money into infrastructure, it was supposed to improve the education system. Barely any part of the Build Back Better plan made it past legislation.
Biden's approval rating is currently the lowest of his presidency at just 40%. The Democrats lost control of the lower House of Representatives in the midterm elections due to widespread disillusionment. The country now faces 2 years of congressional dysfunction, and many wonder if the progressive spirit of 2020 can be recaptured.
Every time Republicans have control, they will use whatever power they can, little or a lot, to get what they want passed. Whenever Democrats are in charge, whatever the Republicans left them, they'll cling on to it no matter how far, you know, right it advanced. And so the strategy here is it's bipartisan if you look at the big picture. The Republicans move things right. They take away all these social and civil liberties, and the Democrats, when elected, preserve just exactly where they are so that when the Republicans win again, they can move them further right.
Record inflation, another recession, a divided Congress, and no end to forever war. The Biden era can't be defined by just one crisis. A recent poll found that 60% of Democrats don't want Biden to run for re-election in 2024. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Afghanistan is witnessing its coldest winter in 15 years, adding to the misery of millions who are already struggling with multiple crises. Umar Khan, a Kabul resident and a father of seven, lives in a cold shack. Two of his children are severely sick. Without a job and relief assistance, he has been unable to afford food, heating, and medication for his family. This situation has triggered fears of human losses.
As I told you, this son of mine collects plastic bottles and waste for one-time heating during the day. I was unemployed almost the entire year, and I couldn't afford fuel or winter clothes for my children. This other son is suffering from the disease of kidney stones. In such a situation, I'm afraid my children may go undernourished or freeze to death. This is a catastrophic moment, and I'm wondering what to do.
Meanwhile, the United Nations has put Afghanistan on its list of 11 crisis hotspots in 2023. The UN survey shows that two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, over 28 million people, need humanitarian aid. Heads of households, like Shah Gul, say they can't cope with the harsh winter alone.
We can't afford more than one meal per day. We used to buy some loaves of bread and potatoes, but today they're also gone from the table. We're not living a life in this cold room with no blanket or enough clothes. When the Taliban took power, everyone was saying that Afghanistan is going to see peace. But what about jobs, earning an income and food? We need the Taliban administration and aid groups to reach out to us before we die from hunger or cold.
This comes as major aid groups have suspended their missions following the Taliban's ban on female workers. For many Afghans, the services provided by the NGOs were a lifeline that has been removed at the worst possible moment. Afghanistan is grappling with economic, political, and human rights crisis. Experts said the Taliban administration's restrictive measures, coupled with Western sanctions, are worsening the situation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of high school students have hit the streets of the Italian capital to rally against what they call the school system in grave decay at the service of companies and private interests. The protest took aim at a 2015 school reform named the Good School by then Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. The reform radically transformed the Italian education system, introducing measures including granting more powers to principals, a new national recruitment process for teachers, and obligatory work experience programs for high school students.
The 2015 reform brought private interests into our schools. From that year onwards, the company's interests came first, not our preparation. The rat race had just begun.
The reform has legalized the exploitation of us students. We are obliged to work unpaid for businesses. It's completely useless and unfair.
Students at the rally said the initiative was also called to remember Lorenzo Parrelli, an 18-year-old boy who was crushed by a metal bar while on a school training placement at a factory in northern Italy a year ago.
Lorenzo was assassinated by the work placement program. He was working in a factory for free, with no safety measures in place. Two more people have died under that program and simply in the interest of the capitalistic economy.
Recently, an international family caused a stir by saying they had to leave Italy due to the appalling conditions of the education system. While schools vary around the country, statistics show that educational standards overall are consistently below the EU average.
Italy is the country in the European Union that invests the least in public education. According to data by the European Statistical Agency Eurostat, Italy allocates about 8% of its public spending in this field, placing it last after Greece and well below the EU average of about 10%. Max Civili, Rome.
Women scientists and cultural and high-ranking political figures from 28 countries across the globe gathered in the Iranian capital, Tehran, to celebrate the efforts and achievements of women worldwide in a conference dedicated to women of influence. The first of its kind, an initiative of Iran's First Lady, Jamile Alam-ul-Hoda, based on what used to be a ceremony limited to Iranian women in previous years. The conference was aimed at showing appreciation for women of influence while offering support and help for them to grow and promote their ideas, as Ensia Khazali, Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs, stated in her opening remarks. With Anna Hakopian, the wife of Armenia's prime minister, emphasizing the important role women play in promoting tolerance and peaceful coexistence.
About 300 foreign guests are taking part in this conference, 70 of them female officials and politicians. The conference itself is held in three different levels: cultural, scientific, and a special panel for ministers and first ladies.
Morning and afternoon sessions were held to provide a platform for the participants in order to share their ideas and valuable experiences regarding the challenges that women face in today's world. The conference wrapped up with Iran's First Lady thanking her guests for supporting the initiative and a special ceremony where the Goharshad Prize was awarded to seven of the influential women, recognizing their outstanding performance and contributions. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Already in 2023, 30 refugees have drowned in the Mediterranean Sea as they attempted to reach the EU, according to figures from the United Nations. The EU's border and coast guard agency, Frontex, has in the past been lambasted for pushing back unsafe boats, resulting in deaths. On Thursday, the new head of the agency vowed to end this practice.
I am responsible for the fact that my people don't participate in anything called a pushback. So I think that is absolutely clear. That is the legal framework I work in. So that's it.
According to OLAF, the EU's anti-fraud office, at least 2,000 refugees drowned in the Aegean Sea during 2020 and 2021 as they were pushed back from the EU coastline by Frontex. The agency prevented at least 40,000 asylum seekers from reaching the EU, which blatantly breaks international law. In just 10 months, the EU has welcomed more than 4 million Ukrainian refugees. They are afforded all the same rights as EU citizens. However, if you're from a different part of the world, torn up by Western powers, it's a different story. We visited a shelter for Afghans in Brussels.
Before we come in the Europe, we think the Europe care about women, care about children. Now we come in here, not. They don't care about women, they don't care about children.
When the children go to school, they need food, they need clothes. And for everything, we need to work. So we need the job permit.
There are no such problems for Ukrainians. Of course, that's to be welcomed, but rights groups are asking why the discrimination. EU Home Affairs ministers will meet in Stockholm, Sweden next Thursday to agree on a more effective strategy to deport asylum seekers who don't meet refugee status criteria. Campaigners point out there are no plans to adopt a similar policy for refugees arriving here from Western Ukraine, arguably a relatively safe region. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Could the UK witness a renewed push by religious communities to remove a controversial relationship and sex education, also known as RSE lessons, in British schools? It appears the appetite is huge after an online petition on the UK government website rocketed to well over 130,000 signatures in just a few days.
The petition focuses on tackling just one aspect of RSE, which many parents find concerning, LGBT relationship education, which is a lifestyle not condoned by the three Abrahamic faiths. However, there is a growing anti-RSE movement, which is campaigning for the total removal of RSE from the state curriculum, as activists believe that it is parents who should be teaching their kids about this sensitive subject matter rather than state-funded teachers.
RSE is currently mandatory in British schools, teaching kids about relationships and sex education, including same-gender relations. The lessons have been marred with controversy, sparking Muslim-majority parent protests as far back as 2019. Parents alleged their kids were being indoctrinated by secular worldviews and what they call LGBT propaganda.
We believe that, that the subjects, they should be able to withdraw from this type of subject. So the No Outsiders campaign, so we just want to able to have control over what they are being taught.
Speaking to a local Muslim activist, Shakil Afsar explained why he feels the petition received so much support.
I think it would have got a lot more signatures if there wasn't this
pro-LGBT narrative in our society, where if you speak against them, you are completely shut down, locked up, and the keys thrown away. I think there would have been a lot more. And I think with the people who have signed, they are people who are at the forefront of understanding what's happening. There are many people who don't really understand the situation. They don't even really know what's happening until their children are coming home with these books. I believe that if there was a transparent media, this petition would have signatures in the millions.
So far, the protests have largely received negative coverage, with the establishment refusing to budge on the RSE curriculum. Activists believe this uncompromising stance could boil over to more parent protests in 2023. Robert Carter, London.
Yemenis are growing frustrated with the United Nations' failure to condemn the Saudi-led war on Yemen, or to hold them responsible for the ensued disastrous ramifications. This comes just days after the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, addressed the United Nations Security Council about the situation in Yemen. While calling for an end to violence, Grundberg declined to condemn the ongoing Saudi artillery shelling that has killed or injured dozens of civilians in the northern province of Sada.
I call on the parties to respect international humanitarian law. Military activity, combined with negative rhetoric and escalatory political and economic measures, create a situation where a simple miscalculation could reignite a cycle of violence that will be difficult.
Grundberg also called for humanitarian aid to Yemen, but mentioned nothing about the lifting of the Saudi blockade, which is the main obstacle preventing vital aid and food supplies from entering the country. This military general we spoke with on the streets of the Yemeni capital says the United Nations is the root cause of all evil in Yemen.
The UN destroys every country they get involved in. Look at what they did in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Sudan. As for Yemen, the United Nations and all of its envoys' efforts in Yemen have been directed at spying on Yemenis, instigating conflicts among Yemenis and fueling chaos and instability.
Some Yemenis are calling on their government to abandon all political talks with the UN. They accuse the UN of complicity with the Saudi-led coalition in the killing of Yemenis. The Yemeni government stated that if the blockade is not lifted and salaries are not paid, the only option left is war.
The Yemeni people and government have expressed that the 8-year Saudi-imposed siege on Yemen must be broken by any means necessary. This after years of failed political efforts to resolve the conflict by the United Nations, an entity which most Yemenis lost trust in and accused of supporting the Saudi military aggression on Yemen. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Tehran has hosted the first International Congress on Influential Women. The 2-day event is underway in the Iranian capital with the participation of influential, active, and elite women from almost 90 world countries. Addressing the Congress, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi called on the participating women at the Congress to benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran with regard to women's rights.
We hope that the participants of this Congress, through cooperation and interaction, will be able to take necessary measures for the rights of women in the world and benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the field of protecting women's rights and paying special attention to women's role in the society. I hope this Congress will prepare the ground for further cooperation among countries in this field.
The event is aimed at identifying, supporting, and developing the abilities and capabilities of elite and influential women at national and international level.
Women are suffering worldwide. This is just because we have not been together. And most importantly, this is the very first time for the Islamic country of Iran to host such a big occasion. So I am so happy to be here, and I hope the relationship with our sisters, women in the world, we should work hard, very strongly, and look forward to the international world to assist women than ever before.
It is extremely important to integrate women in peace building
process. So this conference is extremely important because we know that we have a peace threatened in many parts of the world. And when we look for solutions, women should be involved.
Special awards with international recognition are slated to be granted to influential women in three fields of science and technology, economic and social affairs.
The Congress International of the Women, it's very important for the women in the Islam. For the development, the communication with the country, for example, Algeria, the women Algeria and the women Iraq, and it take the relation very important because the Islam it's number one.
The influential women have been selected from among housewives, women employees, female social activists, as well as competent women in digital technology, social media, science and technology, entrepreneurship, and those who are pioneers in areas of culture and charity affairs.
On the sidelines of the Congress, a memorandum of understanding was signed among Afghanistan's neighboring countries at the initiative of Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs to help Afghan girls and women continue their education. Sama Kujuri, Tehran.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The EU sanctions Iran, the UK sanctions Iran, then the US sanctions Iran, all in one day. The sanctions against Iranian and IRGC officials over alleged protest suppression, in which Iran calls the protesters rioters. Well, it appears that the EU, US, and EU countries are all working overtime to continue with their maximum pressure policy on Iran, which has gone through the test of time, yielding only one result, and that has been a failure. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how these countries that sanction Iranian officials on the basis of human rights are all guilty of that crime. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah McNair, journalist and political analyst, joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is Shabir Rizvi, political analyst, who joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Elijah McNair, welcome to the program. We have, what are we looking at here? Well, let's go with the EU sanctions first. 37 more Iranian officials and entities, basically an asset freeze and visa ban, blacklist over the rioters targeting the Minister of Sports and the commander of the Revolutionary Guards Corps in 12 regions of Iran. Now, this is the fourth round of sanctions coming from the EU. Aside from getting your reaction on this, do you agree that the EU as a whole has been very proactive, even compared to the US in some sense recently, when it comes to the rioters and then of course the sanctions against Iran and its officials and entities?
Well, I think one should not overestimate the EU decisions, because at the end of the day, when the US imposed sanctions on Iran and abandoned the JCPOA, no EU country respected the deal with Iran, and they all, without announcing it, respected the sanctions imposed on Iran. Therefore, all the thousands of sanctions imposed by the US, the EU is abiding by exactly the same sanctions against the Iranians. So what new can the EU bring on the table to Iran. The only thing that the EU is doing is making Iran more sensitive to the fact that Iran should not rely on the EU, and that the EU and the US are both on the same boat. They have the same behavior. One is dealing like a good cup, bad cup. And then you have the European saying, well, maybe all these sanctions are emotional or reaction or non-binding, or we can think about it, or we can have a talk about it. But at the end of the day, they all aim to reach several objectives. First of all is to put pressure on Iran. Second, because of the JCPOA, they want Iran to return to the table, but even if they are saying that the deal is dead. Third, every time they impose sanctions, Iran is reacting harshly and is increasing the escalation rather than abiding by the European or the Americans' sanction and bowing to it. Also, if you look at the general picture in the Middle East, the Egyptian, the Syrian, the Iraqi armies have been kind of exhausted by all these wars, and what remains is only Iran in the Middle East with a strong army that can stand on its feet and can represent a deterrence against the U.S. policy in the Middle East. So basically what we're seeing here is further pressure on Iran, further psychological pressure, but at the end of the day, in matter of practicality, nothing has changed.
Taking a look at the statement you made there in terms of the way Borrell thinks about this, Shabir Rizvi, I was trying to come up with an exact quote of Borrell where he has said that you, foreign policy chief, where he has said that, pressure by the EU at this point is maybe comes out of sensitivity towards Iran and, again, what they call protests, which we call rioters. But what our guest Elijah Magnier says, where it's actually both the U.S. and the EU teaming up together and going through with these sanctions, but that comes that is a very risky decision at this point in time to make, isn't it, when you have the type of reaction coming from the Islamic Republic, which, I don't know if you're aware, but the Iranian foreign minister said that we will be thinking twice about being a member of the NPT, and also whether we will go ahead if the IRGC is labeled as a terrorist organization by the EU to basically kick out the, the IAEA inspectors out of Iran. That's a very risky move to make in terms of sanctions with that type of reaction coming from Iran, isn't it?
Well, look, good afternoon. Thank you very much. At the end of the day, as our guest from Brussels has quite sort of admirably sort of put, and he's taken some of the thunder off what I was about to say. However, what's really very clear that over the last 43 years, now we are weeks away from the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and also the 70th anniversary of when Mossadegh was got rid of way back in 1953. So there are a number of interesting sort of anniversaries happening, and Iran has proved to be quite resilient over the last 43 years to survive all kinds of sanctions. If it was some other nation, it might have succumbed to all the sanctions that have been applied to the Islamic Republic. Not only has it survived, as I have commented previously, it has actually progressed at many, many levels. There's no point in sort of enumerating all the achievements that have been accomplished over the last 43 years. Suffice it to say, then, when the West talks about that women are marginalized, and it's really sort of ironic whenever you listen to the mainstream media, they always say that over 60% of the women undergraduates and graduates in Iran are women. It's over 60%, majority. So where is sort of this marginalization of women taking place in Iran? Yes, Iran has its own ethics. Iran has its own culture. Iran has its own way of operation, which may be different from what the West may think. The problem, the challenge with the West is not only are they working over time, but they're actually working on steroids at this moment. On the one hand, they've got the problem in Ukraine, which they have sort of created themselves vis-a-vis Russia and the special operation. And on the other hand, they're trying to sort of create problems for Iran. And they're fighting another war in with China. So I don't know how many fronts can Brussels or European Union, Washington, London, or Paris can accomplish. The main thing is the mindset of the Western elite is, like Mr. Borrell, you were just quoting, he not long ago said that only Europe is a garden and the rest of the world is jungle. So that's the mindset of the elite when they think that anyone other than European white-eyed blonde is from the jungle, less educated, less enlightened, with less culture, and it's their own culture which is very, very important. And I think the world is realizing that very clearly. And only recently, in the last few days, as you might have seen, the South African foreign minister has quite strongly criticized the USA for not having relationship with Russia. So, you know, there are different alliances which have taken place, the BRICS countries, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Eurasian, the rail link from St. Petersburg all the way to Chabahar and to India. All these things are sort of really making Europe terribly angry that Iran is able to survive. And it's that anger which I think is coming out in these resolutions, which really have no meaning, and they can't be really applied in any way at all.
Well, in a sense, I don't know if you agree, Elijah Magnier. I mean, taking a look at just this past 24 hours, you're looking at the U.S., the U.K., and the European Union to come out and slap sanctions on Iran. Of course, we know that a lot of these sanctions are somewhat not only repetitive, because the IRGC members have been sanctioned since the year 2010, but they have defied any purpose of success based on the fact that, well, Iran has been resilient, as our guest there used that word, against sanctions. But what's very interesting over here is when it comes to the UK that I'd like to ask you about, since it has gone ahead and imposed some sanctions. And one of the sanctions, aside from what I'm looking at over here, is the morality police, which it has done before, but it has gone again, put that sanction on there. And just this past week, you have the UK police commissioner, which came out, introduced a 2-year reform package for the Met, for the police there, where it has been described as rotten to the core, accused, again, the police of the UK, of being racist, misogynistic, where you have one scandal after another, the most recent one, involving David Carrick. And I'm going to name it because we need to get names out since they are so good at doing that when it comes to Iran, who's a former Met police now, but he pleaded guilty to 49 offenses, 24 counts of rape against 12 women between 2003 and 2020. So bad, it's described as rotten to the core of the police in the UK. The point I'm trying to make is that here you have the UK accusing Iran of so many things that it itself, in its police department, is described this way.
Well, perhaps you don't know that until 2021, police officers in the U.S. were allowed to sleep with the people they detained in custody, in the police custody. And only last year, only 2021, mid-2021, the Congress changed the law. Also, we have the information coming from the U.S., that 1,150 people died in police custody last year, when the year before there were 1,054. So the double standard and the hypocrisy of the West is a trademark that has been going on for a very long time. We should not look at what the UK is doing or what the EU is doing or what is happening in the US, because in the West there is a mentality here that we can do what we want, you can't do what we do. So we make the law and we don't respect these laws. We break the international laws because it is our right. This is the colonialism mentality and approach, as my guest, your guest rightly said, Josep Borrell, saying that we are the garden and the rest of the world is a jungle. So this is the mentality that in the West people think of the rest of the world. So there is no point in really making a distinction between the UK or the EU or the US. All the whole 17 or 16% of the world that represent the West. This is why the Iranian government is turning toward the Shanghai Agreement, is welcome in the BRICS soon, is looking at the majority of the world population toward Asia and toward Latin America to link with, because there is no hope of the West. The EU doesn't have an army. The EU thinks that it is in its power to imitate the US and start imposing sanctions left, right, and center, thinking that this is the way to break the population's will and to force the population to look toward the West, saying, well, please lift these sanctions so we can do whatever you want. It's not going to happen. Since 1979, is not happening in Iran. And the more there are sanctions imposed on Iran, the harsher the reaction is from the Iranian. As you rightly said, if Iran pulls out of the NPT, this is going to be a serious alarm raised in the West, saying, well, maybe Iran is really thinking about making a nuclear bomb. Well, I don't think it's a very bad idea, even if the foreign minister, Abdullahian, said that he received a call from Joseph Borrell saying, well, it is not binding and these decisions of parliament is really not something that we can take on board immediately.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, it is exactly the same U.S. behavior that the EU is imitating, including the U.K.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, the point that you make is important there, Elijah Magnier. I mean, Shabir Rizvi, Elijah Magnier says there, you know, what's the difference if the EU is making the statement or the UK or the US and blasting Iran, demonizing Iran, or Iran has said on many cases where this Iranophobia sentiment is what is being advertised by the three, so to speak. But when you have Iran has said, this constant hybrid war against the Iranian nation, as Iran's foreign minister has said, a psychological, media, and economic sectors all just being targeted by the EU, by the US, and by the UK, which is hosting not only a station that is called a terrorist media organization by Iran, but also by the state-funded media by the name of the BBC, targeting Iran, a Persian language station, targeting Iran the way that it is. What should Iran do? Shouldn't Iran then respond? And shouldn't they be careful of how much and to what degree they are actually waging this war, again, not a physical war, but the media war against Iran and with the statements that they're making?
Well, look, as far as wars are concerned, there are many types of wars. We have the sanctions, the economic warfare, media warfare, cultural warfare, and as the Rahbar, the Islamic Republic Ayatollah Khamenei, has quite clearly pointed out that the battle is not on the battlefield with arms and guns and soldiers. It's really a war of culture, the war of media, the war of trying to sort of persuade the people in other countries to turn against them. And of course, you know, Britain, unlike USA and other nations in Europe, has a deep history of colonialism over the last 200 years. although it's no longer a colonial power, but the Foreign Office has thick files in its drawers about how to manipulate and sort of organize dissent in countries. And I think, you know, Washington works very closely with London because London has all kinds of information. It has academic centers like the School of African and Oriental Studies, which was set up by the intelligence services really to understand other cultures, other languages, so that they can manipulate those particular nations from an academic point of view. So there's a war taking place at multiple levels. And I think Iran obviously has to up its game as far as media is concerned. Of course, it's very difficult for Iran as one particular nation when the whole West is spending millions and billions of dollars either through PR agencies or through sort of mainstream media, through social media. All kinds of battles and wars are being fought, and Iran has to perhaps organize at that level itself, because there is certainly a lot of goodwill for Iran in the countries that are also former colonies of Britain, France, and in the recent past of the USA. They realize that USA is not a friend, and as someone famously said, that it's dangerous to be an enemy of USA, but it's fatal to be a friend of the USA. So the reality is that people are realizing that friendship with the USA is really a fatal decision that a nation takes. And a lot of nations are really realizing that situation very clearly.
Sure. Well, but what do you make, Elijah Magnier, of the statement or the stance that the U.S. has taken when it comes to the JCPOA sanctions lifting talks, where in particular the U.S., envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, has said, our focus is not these talks, our focus is what's going on inside of Iran. Now, I would like to take one example of one of their focuses, which I think it's a good one at this point in time, to talk about on, and how that the U.S. is actually focused on Iraq. And basically, to put it in a nutshell, they are trying to exert a lot of pressure on Iraq from the money flow that comes from Iraq in any shape or form when it comes to foreign currency, in particular the dollar, to Iran, where the Iraqi lawmakers are actually accusing the U.S. of weaponizing the dollar, in this case against Iran, where they have said, and this is a quote from one of them, working against us, in reference to the U.S., could lead to bringing down your governments. This is the American message, as it has been said by Iraqi lawmakers, some of them. So is this what the U.S. wants to do? Obviously, we know it's the regime change that they're after, but are we talking about these types of acts by the U.S. Instead of focusing on the sanction removal talks, which the Iran is somewhat waiting for them to see what's going to happen, although not indefinitely?
Well, the problem with Iraq is all the oil money goes to New York, and it is held by the U.S. Central Bank. Therefore, the Iraqis are really caught with the U.S. decision upon their sovereignty. And what the Americans did in Lebanon is to try out the market from the U.S. dollar, creating a big catastrophic financial crisis in the country with the devaluation of the local currency because of that. So this is one of the weapons that the Americans use against the countries whenever they want to really bring them on their knees. So with Iraq is a bit different because the Americans need the Iraqi oil because the Americans and the Europeans have decided to put a cap on the price of energy that coming from Russia, and that is going to damage the U.S. allies. So they can go to a certain point. We have seen that they allowed Iraq to a certain point to give back some of the money to Iran because Iran is selling gas to Iraq and should pay for it and is really back in paying the bills. But at the end of the day, what the Americans are trying to do is exactly what the Iranian officials said. Above the table, they say the JCPOA is dead. under the table, they send messages and they say, we want to talk. The problem here is the Americans are very confident that the Iranians are not going to build the nuclear weapons. And because of that, there is no interest in America or in all the warmongers in the United States and in Europe to go and strike a deal with Iran. This is why they say the JCPOA is dead, because it is in the advantage of the U.S. to see Iran under sanctions indefinitely, because Iran has areas of influence in the Middle East. It has allies, it's supporting the oppressed people in the Middle East and in Latin America. So this is not in the advantage of the U.S. to relieve Iran from the sanctions. This is why they're taking their time. It is not the priority. Today, the priority is how, for the Americans, is how to bring the Europeans together under one banner, because we are suffering tremendously here in Europe because of sanctions that we have imposed on Russia, and we're having a very harsh boomerang effect. This is why the Americans are trying to concentrate away from the JCPOA, because Iran is not compromising on its guarantee that is asking the Americans to provide.
Okay. I'm quickly going to ask this question as is the last one, Shabir Rizvi. The world is changing. The tectonic shift has happened. Iran is moving away. Alliances are being built, like trade blocks, like the SCO, where Iran became a member, and the pivot that Iran has made in that regard is full steam ahead. What are we looking at a point where the U.S. will not be the center of gravity when it comes to its sanctions policy and its financial tentacles to be cut off, so that there will not be this strong dollar, which there are indications, obviously, of a de-dollarization, which therefore will then leave the U.S. out in the cold? Even with its allies like the EU, we're seeing a divergence, like in Ukraine, like when it comes to their China policy. Less than a minute, please.
Well, big topic, less than a minute. So I'll give you a sort of bullet point very quickly. The reality is that the dollar hegemony is being reduced and has reduced significantly over the last few years. But certainly since the Ukraine-Russia issue, it has moved really quite fast. Russia has been trading with India, with other nations in their own currency and also in gold. China at the same time is also trading with the Middle Eastern oil producers in yuan. So, you know, the whole power of the dollar is diminishing significantly.
Thank you. I'm sorry to cut you off. We're just fresh out of time. It was a pleasure, though. Shabir Rizvi, political analyst from London. Elijah Magnier, thank you. Journalist and political analyst from Brussels. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.